chance, no showers, maybe an inch of accumulation. High today, 39. More tonight, cloudy and cold, maybe another inch of snow overnight, a low of 22. Saturday, sunny and 37. Sunday, cloudy and windy, light rain mixed with freezing rain in the morning. Yikes. Sunday's high, though, will be 53. Light snow moving through the area now, 33 degrees, Kenosha and Racine, 31 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I feel tears welling up, calling deep inside, like my heart's strung a beef prick. And the stab of loneliness, sharp and painful, that I may never shake. Now you might say that I was taking it hard since you wrote me off with a call. But don't you wager that'll hide the sorrow when I may rear right down and fall. Now the race is on, and here comes pride at the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running. True love scratched for another's sake. The race is on and it looks like heartaches. And the winner loses all.
That voice belongs to one of the great giants of country music history, George Jones. And we're playing some singing of George Jones because we have with us on the telephone the author of a fascinating new biography about George Jones, a book called The Grand Tour, The Life and Music of George Jones, someone who had one of the most unmistakable voices and unmistakable stylings of any country music singer, one of the best in history, actually, but also, of course, a very troubled man, as many of you might know, even those of you who are not country music fans. But the stories of George Jones and the personal demons which he struggled to keep at bay are really well known, even beyond the hallways of country music itself. And I can't think of anyone better suited to explore the complicated life and legacy of George Jones than music critic and journalist Rich Kinsley, who for many, many years was a contributing editor for Country Music Magazine and now a regular contributor to Vintage Guitar Magazine. His work has appeared in all kinds of different places. He's written liner notes for literally hundreds of albums, and he is the author of books like Southwest Shuffle, Pioneers of Honky Tonk, Western Swing and Country Jazz, and Great Guitarists, the Most Influential Players in Blues, Country Music, Jazz, and Rock. This latest book, again called The Grand Tour, The Life and Music of George Jones, is published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. Rich Kinsley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be here.
I have to say that I am not a big fan of country music, not a connoisseur. I don't know a whole lot about it. I'm more of an opera fan, and I don't mean grand old Opry, but, you know, opera. But I found this book absolutely fascinating, and I'm taking the time to say that because I think it's really important that that people think about exploring the stories of singers that even might reside in sort of areas of music that might not be what you yourself enjoy listening to. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's pretty much beside the point. This story is still a fascinating story, even if you've never really listened to George Jones or are not particularly a fan of what he did musically. I don't know, have you heard that from anybody else, that you don't need to be a country music fan to find this story and this book really interesting?
Well, my own listening goes far beyond country music, mostly into jazz and vintage rock and the Great American Songbook, and that in some ways is helpful to establish a context for what someone like George did and its impact not only in the country music field, but also in American popular music beyond the country genre.
How did you go about digging into the details behind sort of the public facade of George Jones? There's obviously a lot that was already known about him, but you, of course, wanted to probe more deeply into who he was and why he was the person he was. How challenging was that, and where did you go in order to try to flesh out the story of George Jones?
Well, there had been the first biographies on him were written in the mid-'80s, about the time when he began to turn his life around and his career around. And they were out there, and then in 1996 he did his own autobiography titled I Lived to Tell It All, and that opened up a little bit more. But my background as a historian tends to take me a lot of times off the beaten path, so I wanted to look at the big picture of George's life, not just the crazy stories and all that, but his impact on music, how he was marketed, how he was perceived at the time, and most of all, how he evolved as a vocalist from someone who was very much an imitator to someone who became a stylist who influenced generations of country singers. And I looked at the music itself. I had done a number of record reissue projects involving George, and I had spoken to musicians for that purpose, and I had interviewed George in 2001. So I had something to start with, and the idea was to create a book that was more of a big picture book that you could actually follow the flow of the events of his life and the triumphs and the many pitfalls he had, and also how the music kind of followed him along. I mean, at some of the lowest points in his life, he had some of the greatest triumphs, most notably the song that became his signature tune, He Stopped Loving Her Today. He was in a bad way from cocaine and alcoholism at that point, but he did this recording that almost has really an operatic quality about it, even though it's very country. And that became the song that, despite his many, many other hits, has defined him for the ages, I'd say.
I want to make sure that you take a moment to explain the prologue to the book. I find it so fascinating that your book begins as it does, with two different moments from George Jones's career. And what's interesting is that on the surface, they would seem to be two very similar moments in his career, but on the other hand, drastically different from one another. One was October 12th, 1981. One was September 30th, 1992, both at the Grand Ole Opry House in Nashville, Tennessee. Explain to our listeners why the book begins in this way.
Well, he was at his nadir in 1981 and 82. He had this, and as I just mentioned, he had had this remarkable triumph in 1980 with He Stopped Loving Her Today, and he had won Country Music Association awards in 1980 for that, and then again in 1981, but he was completely shot. He was full of booze. He was full of cocaine. He was supposed to sing there, and he was barely able to talk, much less sing. And he was really at the bottom at the same time it seemed to the world he was at the top. And there was a rather embarrassing moment where the country singer Barbara Mandrell, who was also the MC of the CMA Awards, was singing her hit record called I Was Country When Country Wasn't Cool. George had contributed a little bit of singing to that, and the idea was that George would come up and they would sing it together. Well, George was in no shape to do it, and she had to come down to him and could barely get anything out of him. And even though she was a master entertainer and could cover very well, it was obvious he was in a very, very, very bad and precarious place. Now, you fast forward 11 years, and he has pretty much gotten his demons under control. All the unreliability, the years of unreliability when he was performing and would fail to appear at concerts, which led to the nickname No Show Jones, that was pretty much behind him at that point. He still drank, but his drinking was under control. The cocaine was in the past. And now the people who at the Opry who were looking to, for many years, probably memorialize him, were there to celebrate his induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame. Everyone knew he was going to get there, but the fact was most people thought he would get there posthumously. And so you have this record he did, this single called I Don't Need Your Rocking Chair, which is like a defiant fist shaking at old age, and he's joined by all these younger performers, all of whom had been influenced by him. And then, at the end of that, Randy Travis, who was another young vocalist who had been very influenced by George, inducted him into the Country Music Hall of Fame. So you have those two complete contrasts there, and as George gives his very humble acceptance speech, he asks his wife Nancy, who he rightly credits for his turnaround, to get up and basically take a bow. So you have those remarkable contrasts there over a decade. And my idea is that how he got to 1981 and then how he got to 1992 make for a very fascinating journey.
Absolutely.
That's what I was trying to do.
Right. And, of course, as I said at the top of the interview, I don't think you have to be a country music fan at all to find the story really, really compelling. We're speaking with Rich Kinsley about his book called The Grand Tour, The Life and Music of George Jones. And I think one of the best things you do in your book is you really help us understand where George Jones came from, both geographically and personally. And it really helps us understand why he was the person he was and why he lived the way he lived. Explain to our listeners what the thicket was and how that figured in who he was.
The Big Thicket was an area in East Texas that actually was almost like the swamps and the bayous of Louisiana. It was a remote area. There had been oil exploration and drilling there. There had also been a lot of lumber harvesting there. It was a very rough place to live. There were a lot of people who wouldn't even go near that region. People used to go there to disappear if they didn't want to be found. So the people who lived there had a pretty hard scrabble existence. And George's father basically worked as a laborer. He was able to make a living for a while carving staves for barrels. And he was basically grabbing the lumber himself and doing it. But that was it was an area that was very libertarian. It was an area where bad behavior was often overlooked. One of the cardinal sins of that area would be to be a married man and not support your family. And it had its own code, and that was the area that George grew up in, and that was the culture, the first culture he really knew. And there were aspects of him. In some ways, the man himself was not ever totally knowable by anybody because he came out of that sort of mysterious rural area that was so remote and so isolated from the rest of the world.
Hmm.
The thicket has since, because of all the lumber harvesting, it's a small facsimile of its former self, and it's now protected as a, you know, a national refuge. But it was maybe in some ways the one place where somebody like a George Jones could have emerged and have had the ability to deal with some of the crazy things that he had to deal with.
He was raised by parents who were very, very different from one another. His mother, Clara, was a devout Christian, but his father, George W., was a very, very troubled man, troubled ever since the death of one of his children. That seems to have been a blow which sent him careening towards a life of alcohol abuse. And in turn, he seems to have lashed out at his other children in some very strange ways. But particularly, especially when it came to young George Glenn, this matter of coming home drunk and then demanding performances that his children and especially George, young George, sing for him. Tell us more about that and what kind of scars you think that ultimately left on George Jones as he grew up and became a professional musician.
I think that George Washington Jones, when he was straight and when he wasn't drinking, was a very amiable guy, and he got along with everyone. But when he drank, and that drinking was definitely something that was began in him after his eldest daughter Ethel died at a very young age. And when he would come home drunk, he would come in and he would start dragging the kids out of bed because he came home late, demanding they sing. Now, sometimes George's sisters would push him out the window so he didn't have to be subjected to that, but other times he was basically told sing, and if he didn't want to sing, he got the belt. And if Clara tried to intervene, then sometimes she got the rough end of her husband's wrath. And I think that in some ways, George could be a Jekyll and Hyde. There was, at his core, he shared his mother's compassion and decency and all that. But when he drank, then the George Washington Jones side of him came out. And he could be a handful. He could be violent. But also, I sometimes think that one of the reasons that he may have sometimes dug in his heels and not showed up at performances was when he got in a certain mood or got a certain amount of booze in him, he just decided, somebody's going to tell me to sing and maybe I don't want to sing and I'm not going to do it. And that would maybe trace back, it's a hypothesis, of course, but it may trace back to what he endured in the thicket.
Hmm. Intriguing to think about that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those things that you can't ever know, and I was loath to indulge in too much amateur psychology in there because I think that sometimes undermines biographies unless there was fact. And I think the facts here at least point to that as a possibility of why he was so adamant about that. And, of course, his father and him had a up-and-down relationship. up until the time the old man died. He finally got off the drinking in the 60s when he had a stroke. And it didn't paralyze him, and he quit drinking and went back and started to work again, and he was in pretty good shape up to the time he died.
Hmm. One good thing which his father did at some point was purchase a battery-powered radio, and it was because of that that young George was able to hear broadcasts from the Grand Old Opry. You say these broadcasts captivated him. Who were some of the first singers that he heard in those Grand Old Opry broadcasts that were such an inspiration to him?
Two in particular. The Opry had begun in the 1920s mostly as a collection of string bands. You know, fiddle, banjo, guitar, maybe harmonica. And there weren't a lot of solo performers, but that began to change in the 1930s through two people in particular. One was Roy Acuff, who came from East Tennessee and was known for having a very powerful and soulful and emotional delivery. Roy Acuff was really George's first hero as a singer, and the second one who came on about a year after Acuff was Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass. And George was a bluegrass fan his whole life, and he loved the high tenor that Monroe used when he sang, and he loved bluegrass itself. So those two guys were hugely influential. But then there was a group of singers in Texas that would influence him, you know, during World War II and that, Ernest Tubb being one. Ernest eventually went to the Grand Ole Opry. And also later on, Hank Williams, who was at the Opry. He was not a Texan, of course. He came from Alabama. But Hank became George's number one idol in the late 1940s, and George had the rare privilege of meeting Hank when he was still a very young man. And he was playing with a duo on a radio station in Beaumont. Hank came by to promote his new record, and George actually got to talk to Hank. And one of the things Hank said is, when I was starting out, I sounded a lot like Roy Acuff. And then I realized they already had a Roy Acuff, so I figured I better focus on sounding like myself. George didn't take that to heart. He was still sounding a lot like Hank. Later on, he was influenced by another great Texas singer, Lefty Frizzell. And I mention in the book the way George would stretch a word out. He would take a single syllable word, and he could stretch it into three or four syllables. That was something he got from Lefty Frizzell. So he was a listener. He knew what he was listening to, but it took him a while to synthesize all that and begin to find his own style as a singer.
Hmm. What impact did the tragic death of Hank Williams have on George Jones?
Well, he had been a fan of Hank's probably since Hank had his first records in 1947. But by the time Hank died, George was in the Marines, and he was stationed out at Moffett Field in California, not that far from San Jose. And he was out one night, and it was New Year's Eve and 1953, and when he came back to his barracks, one of his buddies said to him, they said, "Your pal's dead." And there was the newspaper that said Hank Williams is dead. And George just got in his bunk, and he just cried. That was the legacy of Hank Williams was never far from George. As a matter of fact, at one point he recorded a Hank Williams tribute album. In fact, he more than once would go back to the music of Hank Williams. So it was always a touchstone with him. But over time, George began to find his own voice, and at that point, and this would be the late 50s, he began to influence and inspire other country singers to at least use and emulate some of what he did in their own delivery.
Tell us about, tell our listeners about this man named Pappy, who seems to have been the first person who really spoke to George Jones about the importance of him finding his own voice rather than emulating and imitating his own musical idols.
Well, Harold, his name was Harold Westcott Daly. He was a former Marine. He lived in Houston. He had jukeboxes there. He was a record distributor. He became a record retailer, and just through accident, he began to produce some records for a label in California. And at one point, one of the singers he was producing, and he was an older man, called him Pappy, and the name just kind of stuck. Well, in 1952, a guy in Beaumont named Jack Starnes had been managing Lefty Frizzell. They fell out. Jack got some money in a settlement. He decided to start his own record company, but he needed someone with record experience, and he turned to Pappy Daly. So they started a label called Starday, which was a contraction of Starnes and Daly. And they started the label, and it was just local acts they were producing. Well, George had come out of the Marine Corps in the fall of 53, and he was known around the area, so they asked him if he'd like to make records for Starday. Well, George made his first record in Jack Starnes' living room with a bunch of portable studio equipment in early 1954. So once Pappy heard these records and he met George and asked him to sing for him, he came up with the he listened to him sing. He was singing like Hank Williams. He was singing like Bill Monroe. He was singing like Lefty Frizzell. And finally, Pappy said to him, he said, "George, I've heard you sing like Acuff. I've heard you sing like Hank Williams. I've heard you sing like Lefty Frizzell. Can you sing like George Jones?" And honestly, George had never thought about it. Every great musician and vocalist is influenced by someone. And you will often, if you hear their early work, hear the echoes, and often very strong echoes, of the people they idolize and the people that they listen to. And what sets it apart is who eventually overcomes and transcends their roots to begin to create a style of their own. And that was the thing he had to do. It took him, I would say, roughly about a year and a half to start to come up with his own voice. And the way he did that, Hank Williams always sang with kind of a high twang. But George began to incorporate his baritone side of his voice, so he could basically swoop from a baritone up to the tenor and go backwards. Many, many years later, in a documentary on George, Roy Acuff was asked about this, and he said that was one of the marvelous things about George's voice, and he said, "I can't even do that." So it was a journey, and over time, he began to sing in the lower registers, and really that's when he started to come up with some remarkable things. It started with a hit called Tender Years in the early 60s, and that was the style. But if he wanted to, he could still hit the twang. Depended on the song, depended on what he felt suited the song.
At what point in, at one point in the book, you say the voice was a raw nerve put to music. Tell us what you mean by those intriguing words. The voice was a raw nerve put to music.
When he would sing about pain, when he would sing about loss and sorrow, he made you feel as if you were experiencing the pain, all the emotions that the person who was singing, the person whose story George was conveying, was feeling. It was, there was no glossing over it. There was no attempt to sugarcoat it in any way. You were getting the emotions straight up. No anything to glaze it or gloss it over. And in that sense, that's what I perceived when I came up with the concept of the raw nerve. And I think that it certainly was true when he started to do ballads, and even up to tunes like He Stopped Loving Her Today. He had kept that, even though he had evolved as a singer, and even though the background of his recordings had evolved, that was a constant. He never really lost that.
Say a quick word about the most famous of his marriages, which was to another country music legend, Tammy Wynette. Theirs was not a particularly lengthy marriage, although they continued to sing together from time to time, even after they divorced. What do you think was the most important impact on George Jones, his marriage to Tammy Wynette and their frequent collaborations?
Well, Tammy was a fan of George's before she ever became a professional singer, because by that time, he was already a star, and he was her favorite country singer. George didn't know really anything about her until they got to know each other after George got divorced and moved to Nashville. But they had a rapport, and they had a musical rapport that George had only had maybe with one other female singer. He recorded with female singers before Tammy. But they came up with a musical synthesis between the two of them when they sang together, that they were able to play off one another. They were able to use the pain they were going through in their real lives a lot of times to make the songs more real. I mean, there were songs written for those two based on the sort of thing that they had going on in their lives. One example would be a song called We're Gonna Hold On. That was written during a tour when her and George were arguing on the bus, and she said, "George, we just ain't gonna make it." And Tammy he said, "Tammy, we're just gonna have to hold on." Well, the composer happened to be playing on stage with George, and he put that together, and it became probably one of their most enduring records, and that was a guy named Earl Peanut Montgomery. And he wrote that song, and it was clear to everybody this thing had hit written all over it, and it became a number one single. So there was something there, and even in later years, they did one final album in 1995, long after they got divorced. And I talked to Tony Brown at MCA Records, who was one of the executives there, and he was at those sessions. And he said, "George and Tammy were not always in the studio together." Because if you know anything about making records, you know that nowadays they often bring in one person to do one part, and then a few days later they bring in somebody else. When George and Tammy were listening to each other sing on the headphones, their faces would light up. Because that brought back that feeling of musical rapport that they had together.
One thing that it also is intriguing to me is that we think of George Jones as in some respects, a very pure country singer. I don't mean pure in the way he lived, of course, but pure musically. That is, he remained, in a sense, very tied to his roots, true to his roots. At a time when country music eventually began to branch out into other directions that felt a little more pop-related and so on, and allowed other influences to seep in. At least we think of him as not being prone to that, as remaining true to sort of pure country music. And yet there were moments when he seemed open to what might on the surface seem like unlikely partnerships. I wonder if you would say, for instance, a word about his brief partnership with Gene Pitney, which I think is maybe one good example of that.
That was fascinating, and it's important to realize back in the mid-60s when that brief partnership ensued, the idea of country and pop singers working together was exotic. It just simply wasn't done. There was a wall between the two genres, and it was very rarely, if ever, breached. So it was a business decision, basically. The owners of Musicore Records, the label that recorded George and recorded Pitney, the label had started a few years earlier in New York, but Pappy Daly and his partner Art Talmadge bought MusiCorps Records, so they had Gene Pitney already under contract. So Talmadge came up with the idea of, why don't we team George and Gene up? We're probably not going to sell George records to the pop fans, but we might sell some Gene Pitney records to country fans. And in fact, Pitney had a voice that was not bad for country music. He had a very high tenor, and on the records those two made together, George would sing the low part and Pitney would sing the high part. And Pitney was very pleased with the things they did together. And the first time they sang together, he realized he would have to sing high and George would have to sing low. But it worked remarkably well. They didn't have a lot of big hit records. They had a few modest hits, and they did a couple albums together. Pitney even did a country album for MusiCorps on his own. But as he said when he was interviewed, one of the things that made him realize he was going to have to let go of this is there began to be a perception in the music business that Gene Pitney was going country, and that was not his intention. As he said, back in those days, you couldn't cross over from country to pop and then back again like you can in, you know, the 21st century. So they had a good partnership, and I think for the most part, those records hold up admirably.
Speaking of holding up, how would you say George Jones's voice, I mean the actual voice, the instrument, managed to hold up over all of those years in which he was, in a sense, so self-destructive? I mean, in so many cases, living a life like that can really lead to the ruin of one's voice or the ruin of one's health, which in turn undermines your ability to even utilize your voice, even if the voice itself is largely untouched from that kind of abuse. Obviously, George Jones's career managed to sustain for quite a long, long time. How would you characterize the state of the voice itself as we near the end of his career?
Well, inevitably, age is going to affect the singing voice of anyone, even if they work very hard to keep themselves in shape. And I know a lot of people say that for a professional singer, they need to sing every day to keep the vocal cords limber and all that. But with George, he was able to overcome nearly everything in the 50s and 60s. Then in the 70s, when he started to get into the cocaine, it didn't have a good impact, and he was still drinking heavily, and that was true into the 80s. And that's why when he did He Stopped Loving Her Today, it took Billy Sherrill a while, and he had to sort of patch things together to get a cohesive take of that song that he could release. But once George got off of the cocaine, and once he got his drinking under control, his voice was in surprisingly good shape. Unfortunately, as time passed, he began to have respiratory problems. And they eventually worked into COPD, and he found it hard to breathe. And of course, you know, from opera, breath control is everything for any singer.
It really is.
Yeah, and if you start to have trouble with breath control, you are in serious problems. And he was always a heavy smoker. And I'm not a physician, I'm not his physician, but it somehow strikes me that the thing that ultimately did his voice in was the tendency he had towards respiratory problems and all those decades of smoking. And at the end, it was painful because he went out and did that final tour, and he had to have backup singers with him who would jump in when his voice started to go when he was singing a line. It was a painful way to see someone go who at one time had such phenomenal vocal power and who had maintained it despite all the abuse that he had given his voice over the years. But at the end, he just couldn't do it anymore. His desire to go out and perform was intact, but his ability to go out and pull it off was just gone.
Hmm. We would certainly be remiss if we ended this interview without talking about the woman who saved him, namely his wife, Nancy. And I think it's important not only to acknowledge her, but to try to understand just what it is that she did that made such a difference. I mean, because in so many ways, the story of his life's turnaround is so remarkable.
Nancy was basically an ordinary working class woman. She lived in Louisiana. George met her, and I don't know that she was that much, unlike Tammy, she was not the world's number one George fan. She was attracted to the man more than the star. And I think that allowed her to see him in an entirely different way. And the other thing that was important was a lot of leeches and unsavory types had been hanging around George. She didn't care. She said at one point that she didn't care if he wanted to quit singing altogether. She said, I'll go to work and support both of us. She said, I just want that man to be happy. And as time passed and she was able to help him get a hold of himself, and that really kicked in once they moved back to Texas. When they moved back to Texas, not to the thicket, but to an area of East Texas not that far away, he began to get his equilibrium. He got rid of the cocaine. He was back around family, and he began to put his efforts into saving money. He began to put his efforts into building what would be his third country music outdoor park. He had had a couple of them, one in Florida that had done well, and he didn't keep it long, but he kept the one in Texas for several years, and he performed there. He got his friends, all the stars in to perform, and he began to just sort of take it easy being out of the high-pressure atmosphere of Nashville. And it sort of gave him a sort of a ability to reboot himself and get back to those basic Texas roots. And I think that was where he really began to get a hold of himself. He didn't quit drinking. I mean, the people have said, well, she got him to quit drinking. He was able to control his drinking. He was not going on binges. Now, he would slip off every once in a while, but she was able to keep him on an even keel and look out for him, and eventually she became his manager. And that gave him a sense of security that I don't think he had before, because him and Pappy Daly eventually had a falling out, partly because George felt Pappy was making a lot of deals and not even keeping him in the loop. Nancy was looking out for him and only him. She didn't have a bunch of other people she was working with in the business, and that gave him this sense of security where he could be himself, and I think that was something that was absent before. And she had children and all that, and they took to George, and he basically found a new family plus the family he had from back in the thicket. He was extremely fortunate to have come across her when he did, because I'm convinced had it not happened, he would have definitely been posthumously inducted into the Hall of Fame. I don't think there's any question about it.
Do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
We have not talked about George Jones as a composer. We've only really focused on him as a performer and singer, of course, and that is for what is that gives him his greatest renown. But he was a composer, and he was an effective composer, and you say that it's really regrettable that he didn't write more than he did. One of the interesting stories you tell about one of the songs he writes is something that occurred in 1959 when he wrote his song called The Window Up Above. And I think you take the time to tell this story because you think it says a lot about who he was as a song composer. Would you mind sharing this story with our listeners?
He was off the road. Most of the time he was on the road a lot. And that was one of the things that certainly didn't help his second marriage to Shirley, with whom he had two sons. But, you know, the way he did it, it was early in the morning. Shirley was making breakfast, and he really couldn't explain exactly what came in his mind, but somehow the idea of that song came into his mind. And as he said, I didn't have any problems at home or anything. He said, I just thought of it. I got the guitar in the den and sat down, and the idea came to him. It was a very simple, economical song, and it stands with some of his finest work. But even earlier, he was recording songs like Just One More, which was one of his first great drinking songs. He also wrote some songs with Roger Miller, which a lot of people don't realize. And he wrote one song called You Done Me Wrong, a sort of Cajun-flavored thing with Ray Price. So he had the ability to collaborate, and it's regrettable he didn't do more of that, because it was the virtue of simplicity in writing songs is something Hank Williams knew, and it was something George had picked up, but he just never really chose to pursue it in a way that he could have had he wanted to, and he would have come up with some more fine material. There's no question.
Right. You write, this song, like most of his other originals, reflected George's greatest strengths as a composer: simplicity, economy of language, and a complete lack of pretense. And maybe this also helps explain something that you say in the prologue, when you say, George Jones was a common man graced with an uncommon talent. And I suspect the longer we reflect on those words, the more they say about who he was and how he lived his life and how his career played out.
He was the same as his fans. He got more pleasure out of getting on his riding mower, and not he went to the liquor store on the riding mower. That story is a legend that happens to be true, but he liked going out and cutting his grass. He liked sitting around watching movies on the big screen TV. He never really considered himself above or superior to the people who were paying money to buy his records and come to see him at shows. And I think that was one of the reasons that his public was so forgiving of him. No matter how many times he would mess up, most of them stuck by him. And I'm not sure that would have been the case with anybody else, but they had that sense of loyalty. They had that belief that he was ultimately one of them. And that, I think, had a lot to do with sustaining him through his bad period.
The story is told in this remarkable book called The Grand Tour, The Life and Music of George Jones, published by Day Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow, and the author, Rich Kinsley. Rich Kinsley, thank you for writing such an interesting book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for the kind words. It was a pleasure to write the book, and it was a pleasure to talk about it with you.
I lived in fear of waking up each morning and finding that you'd gone from me. There's aching and pain in my heart, for the day was the one that I hated to face. Somebody new came up to win her, and I came out in second place. Now the race is on, and here comes pride at the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. The race is on, and it looks like heartaches, and the winner loses all.
It's 8:58 here on WGTD. Coming up on Monday's morning show, we'll be talking with best-selling author Richard Laranjus about his series called Seven Wonders. Book 7, The Legend of the Rift, has just been published. Also, we'll talk with Kesten Atdal, who is the author of a book called Saving Delaney, a really remarkable story about two women, a lesbian couple, who decided to be surrogate parents on behalf of another couple, and then when it appeared that the child was going to be born Down syndrome, decided to go against the wishes of the other couple and keep the baby and raise her themselves. The story is told in a memoir called Saving Delaney. On Tuesday, Christina Brough, executive in residence at Carthage next week. She is with the U.S. State Department in the Bureau of African Affairs. Next Wednesday, Thomas Carr, paleontologist, talks about his new paper just published